Welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David Latulipe. Well, the play's the thing on this week's edition of the program, as we are visited by a playwright, an actor, musician, and a director. Trumpeter Philip Watt talks about his performances portraying the rise and heroin-fueled fall of Chet Baker in Chetty's Lullaby at Stageworks. The fascinating story of Henrietta Leavitt, an early 20th century woman who made startling discoveries in the man's world of astronomy, is brought to the stage via the pen of playwright Lauren Gunderson. She's here to share details about her new show, Silent Sky, at TheaterWorks. And the multi-talented Bill English from San Francisco Playhouse puts on his directing hat for a return visit to our airwaves to talk about the first West Coast production of Jez Butterworth's epic Tony and Olivier Award-winning play, Jerusalem, set not in the Middle East, but in the West of England. Stay tuned. Of Jerusalem to welcome my first guest, Bill English. Playwright Jez Butterworth's play Jerusalem wowed audiences in London, garnering an Olivier Award for lead actor Mark Rylance before heading to New York, where the actor chalked up a Tony. The larger-than-life Falstaffian character of Johnny Rooster Byron is being portrayed on the stage of the San Francisco Playhouse by Brian Dykstra beginning next week, under the direction of my guest, Bill English. In the 10 years since founding San Francisco Playhouse, the multi-talented Mr. English has overseen its growth from a storefront to a major regional theater company, award-winning. He's been on Open Air before to talk up the good work he's been doing at the Playhouse, and it's a pleasure to welcome him back to the KLW airwaves to share some details about the latest production.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, David.
Hi again, Bill. Super to have you. So, Jerusalem, let's start with a quick synopsis. We're not talking about the Middle East Jerusalem, we're talking about the West of England.
No, it happens in the West of England, in Wiltshire, where the accent is a little bit pirate and kind of a hard R's. So everybody's been working on their accent, and we hired the most wonderful dialect coach in the world, Deborah Sussell, and her daughter Jessica Berman are working with all the actors to... It's a difficult accent and not one that's you normally hear on stage, so they've been working on it every day.
So talk about why is this set in the West of England and called Jerusalem?
Well, I think the playwright Jez Butterworth spent some time out there writing and working on other projects in a little town in Wiltshire. And so he just sort of started having this tremendous appreciation for the land and for the people and the simplicity of life there, and also for what was happening to it. You know, there was just tremendous push from commercial and corporate interests to develop housing for commuter traffic back into London. And so a lot of these little villages are getting overrun with housing tracks and McDonald's and commercialization.
Suburban sprawl, so to speak, but on an English level.
Yes, I like to call it suburbanity.
Okay.
And our leading character, Johnny Rooster Byron, is a former motorcycle daredevil, a la Evel Knievel, that used to make his living jumping 25 buses at like county fairs. He was on the circuit, and he's busted himself up significantly enough that he's taken to squatting on some public land outside a village in Wiltshire. And he lives in a old broken-down 25-foot sort of Airstream-like travel trailer, which we actually had to get. We went out and bought one, a 25-foot trailer, and hauled it to
the... Backed it up to the stage?
Yeah, no, well, we weren't able to back it up to the stage. We actually hauled it to the warehouse of one of our board members, where we cut it apart into about 12 pieces and winched it up the fire escape stairwell and then put it back together on the stage. So that in itself was a fairly awesome undertaking. It also takes place in the woods, so there's a bunch of trees and, you know, it's very rural. It looks really like you'll walk into the theater and think you just stepped into some backwoods, kind of almost a little like an oaky kind of, you know, Appalachian kind of feeling to the world that this play takes place in. Anyway, he's holed up in this little woods, and he's basically taken to selling marijuana to the kids.
But he also has, I hear, I haven't seen the play yet, he's a sort of Svengali figure. Everyone's drawn to him. Is it just for the drugs he's selling?
Or? Yeah, no. He's very magnetic. He's kind of the great thing about the play is that it's very, very naturalistic, down to the dirt and the trailer and everything real. It also has this powerful kind of mythic connection to all scoundrels, past and present. That's why when you mention Falstaff, he's also kind of part Pied Piper. You know, the kids are outcasts, kids that don't fit in. Their parents, some of them have been abused, and that's why they come there. He's kind of a magnet for people that, you know, are the square peg in the round hole, and he nurtures them. And in the sense that they're living in this suburban kind of empty world, he gives them something to think about, something to believe in. He takes them back to the time when the land was rich with legends and almost to a pagan connection of man and woman and land. It was like the American Indians had the connection to the land. And he talks about a giant that built Stonehenge. And he's a myth maker. So he's constantly creating this mythology to sort of counter the commercialization of the world around him. And the kids buy into it and are nurtured by it.
And he is, this character, although he lives in this trailer, he's just people are drawn to him and want to hear these stories.
Absolutely. He's a magnetic storyteller, myth maker, and he's in a way I think I've been working on it. It occurred to me he's kind of like Bacchus or Dionysus. He's like the ancient Greek god of revelry.
Who cannot love and appreciate that?
And so he has these all-night raves out in the forest, and the kids and everybody else comes out there and drinks and parties until dawn, you know. And, you know, in a way, the message is the same. The message of the play is that we need this wildness in it, that this man who's outside the box, the outlaw, the person we can't control, the person who understands that connection, is essential to our survival as a species, that we need him. And he says that. He talks to his little boy at the end of the play. He gets cut. He says, "You see this blood? This is Byron blood, and it's special blood. And they come and they pay me £600 for a pint of my blood because they need it, because they need me." And it's just, the imagery is just like fantastic.
Yeah, it's
you
great
know?
Writing.
Not just because it may be, he may have rare blood, but and there's a dozen stories like that in the play, wonderful stories.
So talk about Jez Butterworth's creation of this. Have you seen or read his other works?
Well, I have. I've seen a couple of his plays. Jerusalem is really the standout. His first play was called Mojo, and it created a big sensation in the West End and won a bunch of awards and sort of made him the British playwright to watch a few years ago. And then Jerusalem has many people consider it to be the best play of the 21st century so far. It's just an amazing piece of writing. I understand it took him 9 years to write it. And he just really dug in depth and just kept working on it until it turned out to be what he wanted. I mean, I think the place where Jez Butterworth and I intersect is like, you hear him say exactly what I say, that theater is our church. It's the place we come to. It's not of any denomination. It's not, you know, Christian or Muslim or Jewish or anything like that, but it's the place we come to celebrate our shared humanity. And it's the place we come for that food that feeds the heart and the soul, you know. He calls it logos and mythos. Logos meaning all the things that we have to survive. A job, money, a house, a car, a cell phone, you know. Mythos is all those things we can't put our finger on and all the things that we need to feed our souls and our heart. And it's like, you know, I call theater the empathy gym. It's a place where we come to practice our powers of compassion. But Jez is very, very much of that same mind. So he and I are just like, you know, bullseye for compatibility. You know, I saw this play for the first time at the Royal Court in London, and I went the next day to his agent's office to inquire about the rights.
Have you talked with him about the
production? Yeah, I have. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've corresponded quite a bit too, mostly email.
Excellent. Yeah. Now, in addition to this Falstaffian character of Johnny, you're working with quite a large cast.
Yeah, it's 15.
15 people.
15. There's this kind of a long-term sidekick cohort, Ginger, who's been hanging around. He maybe came as one of the kids, you know, that are drawn to Johnny in their teens, you know. But he's been there for 10 years, and he's still coming around, and he's kind of like, he wants to be a DJ, but he's never actually been a DJ. And then there are four or five kids who are just teenagers. They're 15 to 17, and they don't really belong, and one of them has been abused, and they come hang out. And then there's the local innkeeper who is a really close friend of his who comes to warn him, because the conflict is that the city, the town, which is expanding and wants to build houses in the area where he is, has gotten a court order to evict him, and the police are going to come the next day and with a bulldozer and raise his trailer and his camp to the ground. So that's where the conflict is, and it's how that conflict is resolved that forms the sort of story of the play.
And resonates with contemporary audiences in San Francisco. No
Absolutely.
Doubt.
You know, it's I think of the Occupy movement as having a lot of resonance with Jerusalem. He's really occupying that land. And in fact, they often refer to him as a gypsy, and it's been recently in the news, and since Jerusalem was written, there have been a lot of incidents of gypsies who'd been camped on land for 300 years, same land, being booted out by local towns that wish to enlarge their wealth, you know, so it's a common thing.
Well, in addition to the Occupy movement that you mentioned, I'm just thinking also of San Francisco evictions that are going on with people that have been in rental housing for decades and decades now, with other landlords with dollar signs in their eyes for development.
I hope it's a story that'll resonate with Americans as well. You know, it's very much steeped in British folklore and British culture, but I think we all get it. We all get this guy, this outlaw, you know, this, you know, rough and tumble kind of guy that people follow, but who is definitely outside the law. Mm-hmm. You know, he reminds me a little of McMurphy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that he doesn't really mean to become a caretaker for a bunch of crazy people, but once the chalice is put down, he can't help but pick it up.
So that's quite a role that Brian Dykstra is stepping into.
Actually, it's Dykstra.
Dykstra, I'm sorry.
He may be
listening. Brian Dykstra, yeah. Well, I hope he is.
Yeah, no, it's the role of a lifetime, you know, and he's absolutely the center of the plays on every page. He has, I think I counted 18 rants that go on for as much as two or three pages.
Wow.
Just these stories he tells about. One of them is about being born on the tip of a bullet, which I won't go into in detail because this is family radio.
At least at this hour, yeah.
but it's, yeah, the stories are immense. And Brian is a perfect person for this part because he's done a lot of Shakespeare in the park, you know, in New York. He was with the with the Public Theater and done many of those productions. And he's also a real kind of a rough, kind of big, rough guy looking guy. But he's also a playwright and a solo performer, so he's done lots of holding forth. The guy can go out there by himself on a stage and talk for a half an hour, and, you know, people will listen to him. And, you know, the classical side of it is that, the language is almost Shakespearean. You know, he says, "I, Rooster Byron, by the power invested in me by my dog Shep," you know, and he goes he goes on and on and on in that mock kingly heroic tone, you know, which you almost really have to have real Shakespearean chops as an actor to play this part. In fact, you definitely do. So you wouldn't want to cast an actor that hadn't done a bunch of Shakespeare.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to it. It's the San Francisco Playhouse West Coast premiere of Jerusalem, a Tony and Olivier Award-winning play by Jez Butterworth, directed by Bill English. Bill, you're clutching your coffee cup and mentioned you're at brink of exhaustion here and anxious to get back to the Playhouse.
I've got to go see a man about a tree.
So in addition to the reassembling the trailer, what challenges are you facing bringing it to the stage?
Well, right now, we've got a whole floor of turf that our painter created backstage in 4x8 sheets that she's now laying out on the stage, to cover up the floor, and lights are getting hung. The psych was just lowered, and we're running a lot of ivy. Part of the set, I wanted to kind of look, the southwest of England is just covered with ancient monuments, not just Stonehenge, but ancient Druid relics everywhere. In fact, some people describe it as a kind of a holy land, because that's where the Celtic culture was most concentrated. So part of the set, I have to have something in the back. And so there's a lot of old, broken-down Druid ruins in the back with ivy. We're covering them with ivy. And
neat. Well, that sounds like... It sounds like a project is what it sounds like. Starts next week, runs through March 8th at the San Francisco Playhouse on Post Street. Beautiful theater that you've worked on and renovated. It's absolutely a gorgeous space. sfplayhouse.org. Bill, I'm going to ask you to just hang out for just a moment later, because my next guest, Lauren Gunderson, and you are collaborating on an upcoming project. Lauren Gunderson, welcome to Open Air. Welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you so much.
You were back here in October to talk about your modern farce, The Taming, and in a moment we're going to talk about Silent Sky, which is at TheatreWorks Silicon Valley. But let's get you guys talking a little bit. What are you collaborating on just down the road?
Bill, you want to take over for a minute?
No.
I've been talking a lot. I know.
Well, we commissioned Lauren to write a play a couple of years ago, and we were drawn to her because I'd read a couple of plays of hers that were both biographical, including Silent Sky, and I thought we were looking for someone to write a play about Rudolf Bauer, who was a contemporary of Kandinsky's, non-objective art, but who suddenly stopped painting forever in the middle of his career because he got into a dispute with Solomon Guggenheim. And it's a true story, and we've been working on it, Lauren and I and a lot of other people, for a couple of years, and we're going to put it up at the Playhouse after Jerusalem.
Well, fantastic.
Nice, it's an exciting thing to be working with a theater that that you love their work as an audience member to then step in as an artist. So I certainly feel that way about SF Playhouse and working with Bill.
Let's have you as a dynamic duo on when it sits up and running.
I love it.
Shall we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. In the meantime, Bill, go back to the Playhouse. I'll talk with Lauren.
All right. Thanks very much, David.
Sure, Bill. I mentioned that Lauren's The Taming was the last subject of her visit here on Open Air. Now to talk about Silent Sky. Lauren's originally from Georgia, playwright, screenwriter, and short story author. She teaches playwriting in San Francisco and has spoken nationally and internationally on arts activism and the intersection of science and theater. Now, it's this specialization, no doubt, that helped or perhaps inspired her play, Silent Sky, being presented by TheatreWorks Silicon Valley, which tells this fascinating story of Henrietta Leavitt, an early 20th century woman who made startling discoveries in the man's world of astronomy. Lauren, once again, welcome back to KLW.
Thanks.
So who was Henrietta Leavitt?
Henrietta was one of a group of women who are incredible Americans. They were mathematicians at a time when doing their work, which they did at the Harvard Observatory, meant that they were functioned as and called computers, because as the line in the play says, a computer is one who computes. So these women...
We forget that, don't we? We do.
There's a long history of women being computers for male scientists and engineers, and this was one of the cases. So it's about 1900, and Henrietta arrives at Harvard Observatory thinking she's going to pursue original research in astronomy, and of course she is handed a notebook and told to do the math of the male astronomers. And in fact, she and her colleagues, all women, were not even allowed to use the telescope because that was a man's world, and they were not invited to use it. But despite all of these challenges and the hardships of doing this kind of science at that time, where the latest technology, so to speak, was the very first glass photographic plates of the sky. So we think of Hubble images now, but back then they were actual plates, and they were negative, so the stars were dark and the sky was white. And so these women scoured the plates. That was their job, to basically map the entire sky. So while doing this, Henrietta focuses on the numbers in a way that none of her male colleagues had been able to do before. And in it, she sees, through her dedication and meticulous work, a pattern in a certain kind of star called a Cepheid variable, which is important because they blink regularly. Some of them blink once a day. They take a month to begin bright and dim. But she found a pattern in these stars which really and literally unlocked the stage for modern astronomy. So her work is directly tied to Edwin Hubble's work, who, of course, would tell the entire world that not only is our galaxy a big one and our universe is a big one, but there are galaxies outside of our own, stars that are billions of light years away. None of this we knew at Henrietta's day. In fact, there was a great debate at the time, which is covered in the play, about how big is our galaxy? Is our galaxy the same thing as the universe? And Henrietta believed that the universe was massive and she wanted to prove it, but we couldn't measure anything. And then here she comes along, finds this incredible pattern, and is able to measure stars all over the sky. So it's with that as the central kind of intellectual component of the play that we fill in the gaps of her life and her heart, and we give her a little romance. And she has a sister who reminds us the kind of people who make creative geniuses' lives possible are often the ones who don't get the credit but are standing by them through the end. And it's about sisterhood that you aren't born with but that you find in your colleagues and compatriots.
How did her story come to you? How did you learn about her?
Well, I write a lot about science and women in history, and so I was kind of shocked that I had never heard of this woman. It's a woman astronomer that I'd never heard of. My goodness. So I found the only book about her that there exists, and it's a very short, slim, thin book. Through the story, I just saw a woman that was at the crux between the old world and the new world. And to be someone who never really got credit and was at a place in time that felt inherently dramatic to me. And also I felt that this could be a play as opposed to an essay or a novel. It was a play because there was music. Math and music are obviously very tied together. And in this play, quite literally, we have an incredible original score by Broadway composer Jenny Gearing, who has matched the kind of math and science of the world with music. So we have, you learn about Henrietta's discovery, this pattern in the stars, in a tonal way. So at the end of the first act, there's a rather breathtaking moment where music and math kind of combust together and blossom. It's really something to behold.
So what sort of fictional elements did you introduce into the factual story of Henrietta?
Well, we don't know a ton about it, so this could have happened. Uh-huh. But with a little bit of artistic license, we get to say, Henrietta, we see a bit of her romance, which we don't know too much about her world. She never married, but we give her the possibility of it. Her mother was a major force in her life and was with her all the way to the end of Henrietta's life. And I kind of shifted out the mother for a sister role to kind of parallel the idea of the sisterhood that was changing in America during the suffragette movement, which this play also covers. So women making strides in science and politics and in the home. So that's a lot of it. I actually added at the end of the play, Henrietta probably didn't get a full grasp of the extent to which her work was being used and appreciated all over the world, and the men who would credit her later. Edwin Hubble said she should have deserved, or she definitely deserved the Nobel Prize, and was actually offered one, but they didn't realize that she'd passed away a year before. So, but she probably didn't get a sense of that. But in this play, I give her just a peek, and then all of the characters in the way that history plays allow us to really look at the past and bring it forward into our world. Those characters kind of speed through time in the last couple minutes of the play and get to see the extent to which all of their work and lives have changed into the world that we know now and leap off into the future.
I'm wondering if she was did she act as kind of a transformational character then to change the opinion of her male colleagues? Or was it basically, oh, very nice work, young lady, we'll consider that. And then they just took her work and used it for their own gain.
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. Okay. She actually was mentored quite beautifully by some of the men, mainly his name is Mr. Pickering, who ran the Harvard Observatory, and he gave her credit and allowed her to publish under her own name a few of her most striking discoveries. And then it took until Edwin Hubble, who saw her work, realized what it meant, and applied it with a couple of other scientific theories floating around at the time to give us the idea that of this, the grand scale and how far away things like the Andromeda Galaxy were, which proved how big we were, which proved how big the universe was. So he always credited her, which makes
That's great.
Hubble a big hero of mine.
Right, right. What else was she involved in the field of astronomy?
You know, she did a lot of work on just collecting and discovering celestial objects that we had no idea were there. So she discovered thousands of these celestial Cepheid variable stars, galaxies, nebulae, novae, all sorts of elements that we wouldn't have been able to pinpoint without her close eye and her colleagues, which included the real astronomers Annie Cannon, who is in the play, and Wilhelmina Fleming. So it was a really interesting idea writing this, because oftentimes we hear stories about women in a man's world, but in this play it's actually a man in a woman's world, because their office, all of the computers were women and they had their own office, and so in reality there was 10 or more of these brilliant women in one office, all crammed together. And I think because of that, they were able to support each other and encourage each other in a way that if you were only one woman among men, there might have been some intimidation that often happens. So a ton of the women who worked in this office that Henrietta worked in became really fundamental actors in modern astronomy. They've discovered, tons of things. The way that we categorize stars by heat came from Annie Cannon, these letters that you hear about in the play that she gave star names. And it really started with these women. So in a way, that's part of what made me want to write this play, is less another story about, oh, it's hard being a woman in a man's world. But it's an incredible space when you do allow women to be their full selves and find their brilliance, certainly with each other.
Tell us something about your cast that you've assembled.
Oh, my gosh. It is such a dream team. So our cast is led by Elena Wright, who has done some wonderful work around the Bay at Cal Shakes and Marin and other places. And she finds a part that is equal parts kind of romantic and quirky and ferociously smart and dedicated. So we have a woman with a great backbone, but a great love of life and a great kind of curiosity that just brightens the room. So she is beautiful and brilliant and dressed in delicious costumes. It's a great thing about a history play, is girls in corsets and hats, and oh my gosh, it's just beautiful. And Jean LeBlanc is one of my favorite actors to work with in the Bay. She was in a play of mine at Shotgun last year. So she is coming on at the part and adds such warmth to a play about a lot of nerds. She plays the sister who adds the kind of art and music element. She plays a musician in the play. So and we have Lynn Sofer and Sarah Dacey Charles, who's coming to us from New York, Broadway actor. And then Matt Citron is also from New York coming to us. And it rounds out just a beautiful cast full of humor and all sorts of wonderful things.
That's playwright Lauren Gunderson. Her work, Silent Sky, directed by Meredith McDonough, opens this weekend, runs through February 9th. Information for the performances at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts in Mountain View is at www.theaterworks.org. Lauren, I wish you a spectacular run of the play, I'm looking forward to catching it down there.
Thank you so much,
Dave. And I love the scarf. She's wearing this beautiful space scarf is how only
I might have got it for this play, because these are the actual stars that Henrietta worked on. It's called the Small Magellanic Cloud. And not only are they interesting, they are beautiful.
Thanks, Lauren, for coming by. More with Philip Watt coming up and Peter Robinson. Stay with us here on Open Air. Thank you. a paper moon as we say goodbye to Silent Sky and Lauren Gunderson. My next guest is Philip Watt. Told with live jazz and set in a cabaret, he's starring in Chetty's Lullaby at Stageworks on Valencia Street for final performances this weekend. It brings the tragic downfall of legendary trumpet player Chet Baker to life, following Chet from heartthrob to drug-addled criminal with a cast of San Francisco-based actors featuring the bop rhythms of the jazz legend. Chet is brought to life by actor Philip Watt, whose most recent production also brought a historical figure to life, Dylan Thomas. He's currently a guest lecturer at Acting for Animators workshops in Denmark and Germany and has not put down the trumpet since starting to play at the age of 10. Philip, welcome to the Open Air Waves.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, you've been doing this production. There's a production of this back in the fall, and there's just two final performances this weekend. How has the performance changed from the earlier version of it?
Okay, yeah. Well, we first had a stage reading in New York a couple summers ago, and then we did a workshop production at Boxcar, and then we did eight performances in 2013 at Viracocha, which is a pretty sought-after, very cool venue on Valencia and 22nd Street. Cabaret. You go in, it's a furniture store, and then there's a door, a secret door. You go downstairs, and it's this whole speakeasy kind of environment.
Right.
And that was really fantastic. And now we've moved to Stageworks, which is the former home of Intersection for the Arts, 84-seat theater, all the bells and whistles, you know. We have 51 light changes now and sound cues, and so finally
it's an actual proper theater instead of a hush-hush theater.
Yeah.
I understand Viracocha is like, well, I'm not supposed to.
Yes, exactly.
Although, but it's a cool space.
Yeah, supposedly Viracocha is working on getting an elevator or something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah. Well, talk about Chet Baker for those of us who don't know about him. I love his sound, and I love his tragic story, but share some of that with
us. Sure. Well, he was born in Yale, Oklahoma, and his dad was a musician as well. Moved to Santa Monica when he was 12. In fact, Don Prell, the bass player who plays here in town, grew up with him, and our piano player, Michael Parsons, plays with Don every week. But Chet was an interesting character in that he, his drug addiction really was sustained through his life, and our play examines the choices he made at around age 30 to, you know, basically have drugs in his view, and his he almost doesn't. He, in a sense, gives up the struggle to quit. But as an artist, as a musician, he was an innovator in the jazz singing style. And, you know, they say that he played trumpet like a singer and sang like a trumpet player.
Interesting. Yeah.
Especially with his scatting.
Yeah.
Musically, incredibly gifted.
Uh-huh. Now, did Chet himself either ever talk about his addiction or his relationship with heroin?
Yeah, he does, actually. At a certain point, I was just reading this morning from Deep in a Dream, The Long Night of Chet Baker, which is a biography by James Gavin. At a certain point, he was doing exposés of his own addiction for money. When it came to, you know, getting forwarded money for whatever it was, he was pretty shameless. And so he did talk about being demonized by it. And that was the early 60s. It was such a public struggle for him. You know, our play reveals what happened in Milan, Italy in 1959 with the famous trial.
What brought him to Italy?
Basically, he lost his cabaret card in Manhattan, so he couldn't play anymore, and he had just done a stint at Rikers Island.
Because of the drugs?
Yeah. And so he, you know, he was also intimidated by the, I guess you could say, you know, some people say he was an early proponent of reverse racism. When he toured with Charlie Parker in the West Coast in 1953-54, Charlie famously, or this is a story that Chet told many times, Charlie went back to New York and said, "Hey, I've met this white cat. You cats got to look out for this guy. You know, he's going to eat you up." And so Chet, through the years, would keep telling this story in the sense of, you know, I had to struggle against this black-on-white bias in order to, you know... and so that was a struggle that I went through in the sense of a type of, you know, racial attitude that not many people had used before, in the sense of it was the 50s, and obviously the deck was stacked usually in the other way, you know. In the 1950s in Europe, he ran into some trouble and spent quite a lot of time in jail.
Now, you bear a striking resemblance to Chet, especially in the publicity photos. It's a fascinating comparison with some of Chet's early life. Now, what's your fascination with Chet Baker? I mean, you've been playing trumpet since 10, but when did you first hear his jazz playing?
Let's see. I actually studied at the same college he did in my 20s. Now it's called LA Community College, and I took the big band and some jazz classes there.
Uh-huh.
It was called El Camino, I think, back in the 50s when he went there. I've listened to him, as well as, you know, some of my other favorite trumpet players, like Clark Terry, who's from my hometown, St. Louis, and Miles Davis, East St. Louis, since I was a teen. As far as this project, it was the summer of 2010. I was playing trumpet at a wedding, and the playwright, Stephen Delbos, was there. He and I met. I was engaged with the Dylan Thomas project at the time. I was touring it to Independence Theater in Kansas. So I was putting all that text in my mind, and then Stephen came out with In My Craft and Soul and Art by Dylan Thomas, so we sort of hit it off. And at the end of the weekend, he decided to write a two-act play for me about Chet. 18 months later, he came out with the first draft.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you're playing Chet at age 30 or so, and he died only at the age of 58 now. You could probably play him as an older character as well, but you'd probably have to have your front teeth knocked out and then replaced. I don't think you're going to go that far as for preparation. But what sort of preparation did you do for this role? I mean, have you tried heroin just to see what it does to your body? Or are you allowed to say on the air? I don't know.
I don't know.
We can talk later about that, maybe.
Sure. if you see the play...
For research purposes,
yes,
we could say.
Yes, you'll see on stage some administration of heroin, obviously, because it's that's a part of the play, is really exploring what, you know, the inner images of his high, why he's so attached to it. Other junkies weren't maybe as maniacally attached to it, and so that's why we're trying to uncover that, because the images of his high... and why he wants to be high, perhaps can shed some light on him. But as far as preparation, you know, it's really just shedding. You know, I took 3 classes at the jazz school in Berkeley. I'm starting a new one tonight. Going to Club Deluxe on Haight-Ashbury and the Revolution Cafe, and getting to know the jazz musicians here in town, like Jay Standards, Mike Olmos, and Smith Dobson, and Michael Parsons, as mentioned. And, you know, it's great to be able to create a character and to utilize what skill I have as a horn player, and then to sort of have that, you know, learning curve be accelerated through rehearsal and preparation.
Let's hear a little bit of Chet and Chetty's Lullaby, the actual tune, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the final performances of Chetty's Lullaby.
Questa notte so per te, dolce bimbo, ti dirò che presto tornerò senza te. sento gelo nel mio cuore, cerco solo l'illusione d'averti qui con me.
The unmistakable sound of Chet Baker here on Open Air. My guest Philip Watt portraying Chet Baker and for final performances of Chetty's Lullaby, a two-act play about the downfall of American jazz trumpeter Chet Baker in Milan in 1959. It's at Stageworks, 446 Valencia Street. Information at chettyslullaby.com. So, Philip, in preparing for the trumpet aspect of Chet's playing, you obviously listen to him a lot. Do you have to do something different than what you would normally play jazz trumpet?
Well, I play three of his solos, so I had someone help me transcribe them. Mm-hmm. They're all about two choruses each. And playing them hundreds of times has been really amazing. Some people say to really learn jazz, you should listen to just one or two albums over and over and over again. So that aspect was there. Getting into, again, like the internal choices that he's making, the melodic line, how he feels the tension within the chorus and the choices that he's making spontaneously. Those are quite fulfilling to study.
And it's a one-person show?
No, it's a cast of...
Oh, that's right. You have a full combo with you.
Sure. It's a cast of nine, actually 10, including me, featuring Angela Chandra playing Halima Baker and his next wife, Carol Jackson, played by Amber Sommerfeld, and then a thug, a drug dealer, the bar owner, played by Irving Shulman. So it's a big cast.
Mm-hmm. So it's set in Milan in 1959, but Chet also has a Bay Area connection quite closely. Could you share some details about his life here in the Bay Area?
Yeah, he was in the Army, and so early on, he was at the Presidio, stationed up there, and he would often leave, he would leave in the night and go out and play. Then later in the 70s, he lived down, I believe, in San Leandro. He had a problem, his teeth were knocked out in the tenderloin. I can't remember, I think it was early 70s.
He had to go through quite a recovery period before he could play again after that.
Yeah, because he, when he was in his 20s, he had one tooth missing.
I didn't know that.
And so he played and, didn't get even when he had money, I guess he just didn't care. But then, he lost his whole grill in the tenderloin. That was through bad drug connections and, honestly, playing him is a challenge because he's so unsympathetic. He's
really unapologetic about the whole addiction and the whole use of heroin, wasn't he?
Yeah, he maintained that he didn't hurt anyone. And so, that this was something necessary for his vision for music and for his staying sort of at a certain level. In the play, towards the end, one of the lines is, "I didn't do anything wrong, not really wrong." Mm-hmm. Which, when you think about Italian rules and the rules of the 50s and the way that they demonized drugs and the way it was so difficult, so incredibly punitive. I can have some sympathy for that. As far as how he treats people, it's interesting to go into that space where, really it's looking out for number one. I'm the boss, and can it? Doesn't mean a thing. Just
right.
Stop talking, please. Yeah.
But if you want to see the ravages of what heroin can do to a person, just Google image Chet Baker. You'll see a beautiful matinee idol looks in his early days to really quite a ravaged person in his later years.
True.
It's sad. And I wish you wonderful performances of this. It's chettyslullaby.com for more information. Are you going to take it elsewhere after this short run? It ends this weekend.
Well, the playwright is coming from Central Europe, so that's going to be full circle. He'll be here. I've contacted a theater in L.A. about it. I might do some smaller things, like maybe get some other episodic type things going on. I feel like it's full circle, unless some theater with a budget of $15,000 wants to come in and say, hey, let's let's put it up in the fall of 2015.
Right, right. Well, let's get through these first couple of performances at StageWorks on Valencia Street first, shall we?
Yes, thanks, David.
Philip, I do just want to mention that you got some interesting press recently here in San Francisco as well, in a costume of sorts. I believe it was as the Riddler. Could you share? There you go. How did that all come about with Bat Kid?
Well, my cousin was the director of it, Jen Watt Wilson. And she just took me out to lunch back in October, and she said, you know, she handed me a picture of Frank Gershon and the Miles Scott, the boy, and asked me if I wanted to do it. And I said, yeah, of course. And I watched Frank Gershon. Unbelievable. I was really impressed and inspired by him. And as soon as I put on that costume, that was the other half of the character work, having all those question marks, dancing around.
Nice.
You know?
You made a kid very happy, I'm sure.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Well, not as the Riddler, but as Chet Baker. You can see Philip Watt in Chetty's Lullaby. Information at chettyslullaby.com. At StageWorks on Friday and Saturday, I believe. Yeah. Last performances. Mm-hmm. chettyslullaby.com. Philip, thanks for staying with us today.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
More with Peter Robinson on the state of San Francisco libraries, and he's sharing some film festival information as well. Taste of Chet Baker there in that cut, looking for the silver lining, which he probably himself thought he found, but dying tragically at the age of 58. Chet Baker, chettyslullaby.com for the performances of Philip Watt as Chet. Welcoming once again Peter Robinson to the airwaves of Open Air. Hey there, Peter.
Good. Good to be here. Good to see you, David.
Indeed. What do you have for us this week?
I was going to give us a quick roundup as to what's been happening with the library system here in San Francisco in the Bay Area. But I was smiling just listening to that Chet Baker, because it did remind me of Bix Beiderbecke, who again, as a horn player, particularly with numbers like I Can't Get Started, in a sense had a parallel type of life. But today, as they say, I will get started. And I was thinking with all the changes happening in the San Francisco library system, many KALW listeners are readers. I remember when Alan Farley used to do book talk and I was doing reviews at the end of that program, we would get a stack of calls from people who clearly were interested in books. And when I started doing the research on the state of the Bay Area and San Francisco libraries, it crossed my mind that I have spent about two-thirds of my life, one way or the other, in libraries, from the Bodleian Library at Oxford, the C Library at Cambridge, the Electronic Library at Google. And here in San Francisco, we have one of the nation's finest library systems. In fact, since the bond measure was passed in 2000, there have been 23 either rebuilds or renovations of libraries across the city. So your own local library is not only improved, it has become in many ways the heart of a community.
Searchable online as well as at sfpl.org.
That's right, that's good. And you can even get electronic books from the library. So if you're a Kindle reader, you can tap in and you don't even have to cross the road and get wet if it's raining to go to get your book. Last week at Tosca's restaurant in North Beach, I was with a group of the Friends of the North Beach Library, which is about to open the new development in the summer. And again, I think this is a good way, if you're interested in reading, of making a connection. Because I mentioned the fact that a library nowadays is a community center. We're talking about computers. We're talking about special evenings where they have movies going on. In my own county, which is Marin County, I've got to say that I'm totally dependent on the reference desk at Sausalito Library. I think often you're on a deadline, you need that critical fact, you can't find it on Google, you call the reference desk, and bingo, that is where the answer comes from. So in many ways, these changes that have been happening around the Bay Area has made the entire library system extremely user-friendly and extremely accessible. And let me give you a couple of examples of programs which are about to open up in the summer. At the main San Francisco Library, they are just building a new literary and learning center, which opens in the summer. And it will be the new home for the already existing 30-year-old adult literacy program known as Project Read. And it will expand all the literacy efforts. And, of course, today literacy takes on new meaning. We talk about technology, literacy, people with learning disabilities, family literacy. And what it does remind me of is a quote from Mark Twain, that the man who does not read has no advantage over the man who cannot read. And I think, once again, what you realize when you come in there, here is a place where people who share the idea that reading is important can get together. And another new addition, which is part of their free classes and their tutoring program, is the Teen Digital Media Lab. It's going to be on the second floor of the main San Francisco Library. And this is specially geared for youth-designed learning. And, of course, it's loaded with all the latest digital media equipment, video, sound recordings, computers, and the types of creative tools that really, in the end, direct you back to books. So when I think about it, if I wanted to spend just a quiet, peaceful 2 hours in an afternoon, and I want to do my quiet thinking, some reading, then what I am very pleased to say is here in San Francisco, we have one of the nation's finest network of libraries.
Indeed.
Coming up, and I think this is of interest not just to book readers but to moviegoers, starting in mid-February on the 13th, is a British Film Festival. Now, they qualify it, they call it the Mostly British Film Festival, and in fact, in the course of the week, screening at the Vogue Theatre on Sacramento Street will be over 20 different movies. Three or four from Ireland, a couple from Australia, one from India, and the rest are British. So this is a good example of how you can combine some classic films with some of the new ones, which probably haven't even screened over here yet. It kicks off with a movie called Le Weekend, a kind of play on the French there, and it stars Jim Broadbent and Linda Duncan as they set out to go on a sentimental journey to Paris after 30 years of marriage, a kind of mini honeymoon with reflections. Amongst the other films are Sliding Doors, the famous one with Gwen Paltrow, where she does a superb British accent. And then Michael York is actually coming to the city. He will be interviewed by Ruth Stein. The movie is called England Made Me, which is a great movie based on a Graham Greene novel. But there are others, including The Hit, which is one of the early Stephen Frears films. You may recall that he is the person behind the current success of Philomena. And then we are rescreening The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, a great Jean Le Carré story starring Richard Burton and Claire Bloom, which I will be introducing. And we're going to be finishing on the 16th of February with Summer in February. And this is really geared for people who like Downton Abbey, since you may remember that Dan Stevens has indeed left the series, but he is back again in this movie. It's called Summer in February. Among the Irish films, The Sea, and one called What Richard Did. And, of course, there'll be a couple of others which people who are more interested in the Australian movie theatre will also enjoy. So this is a lineup at the Vogue Theatre, which is on Sacramento Street. And to get your up-to-date information, go to the website mostlybritish.org, and you can get a full schedule of the Mostly British Film Festival here in San Francisco.
Well, thank you for that insight, Peter. We'll see you again in a couple of weeks, I think.
Okay, good to see you, David. Thank you.
MostlyBritish.org for information about that film festival. And again, information about your San Francisco Public Library System at sfpl.org. Well, that's open air for this week. Just a reminder that the Beethoven Bates Love Fest continues with the San Francisco Symphony, sfsymphony.org. I interviewed Mason a couple weeks ago. If you'd like to listen to that show, just search for Mason Bates at our website, kalw.org. That's where you can hear any of the past open air shows. Look at our program guide, and we've got our recent program guide for winter of 2014 there at kalw.org. You can send us some program suggestions there as well. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that the Peninsula Symphony has its performances Friday at the spankin' new San Mateo Performing Arts Center, featuring Taylor Eigsti and his jazz combo, along with Mitch Klein and the Peninsula Symphony performing works by Gershwin, among others. PeninsulaSymphony.org. Thanks also to Neil Swinkles, producer of Open Air, for keeping things smooth running here. More information about this show and others at kalw.org. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks for listening. A little bit more Chet Baker as we go out.